And Penelope Cruz, if there was a category for, you know, most amazing striptease performance, she would win.
What a tremendously hostile world a rat must endure. Yet not only does he survive, he thrives. Because our little foe has an instinct for survival and preservation second to none. And that, messieurs, what a Jew shares with a rat.
I guess it's a little strange to start with Best Supporting Actor, but since we're there, I just have to mention that there's two... I haven't seen The Last Station, so I can't speak to Christopher Plummer's performance. I'm sure it's fine. He's always fine. The other three, I really like Woody Harrelson in The Messenger. I really like The Messenger a lot. I think Woody Harrelson is extremely good in it, and I'd be thrilled if he won. But I must point out that Stanley Tucci in The Lovely Bones and Matt Damon in Invictus are bad. I mean, they're not even like average. They're both very good actors. And in fact, I would have nominated Stanley Tucci in Julie and Julia, where I think he's quite good. But in The Lovely Bones, he plays this pedophile. And as I overheard one critic say, I mean, if only all pedophiles were that easy to spot, our world would be a better place. And Matt Damon is just, he just sort of, he plays this rugby player and he who doesn't say much. And so it's like, why are we nominating Matt Damon? Matt Damon's a very good actor. And in fact, I wish he would have been nominated for his role in The Informant, where you think he's fantastic. So but anyway, this category bothers me that we have two very good actors nominated in bad movies and bad roles. Not bad movies, actually. I like Invictus, but anyway.
I've only seen of these five, The Messenger, Woody Harrelson, mm-hmm. and Inglourious Basterds, Christoph Waltz. And I don't normally like Woody Harrelson as an actor, but I thought The Messenger was a really strong, mm-hmm. really strong movie,
yeah.
and that he was fine in it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I actually, The Messenger, because it's an Iraq movie and because it, I don't know, it reminds me a bit of The Hurt Locker because of the way it uses certain kinds of set pieces. I really wish that would have been nominated instead. I think that's a much stronger film and one that I think it deserves much more recognition than it's received.
Yeah, overlooked, definitely.
So while we're on supporting, any thoughts on the Best Supporting Actress?
I've only seen Vera Farmiga in Up in the Air and Anna Kendrick in Up in the Air, mm-hmm. and Monique in mm-hmm. Precious.
Mm-hmm.
Monique is surprisingly good in Precious, mm-hmm. but it's one of those like hit you over the head
yeah.
roles where she's just an evil, evil mom.
Yeah.
And that only goes so far. I agree with what you were saying earlier about Vera Farmiga in mm-hmm. Up in the Air. She's really strong.
Yeah. It's Maggie Gyllenhaal in Crazy Heart is a little bit miscast. And so I'm a bit surprised to see her here. I like that film, but I think she's one of the weaker parts of it. And Penelope Cruz, if there was a category for, you know, most amazing striptease performance, she would win. But I'm not sure that the rest of her performance in Nine is necessarily worth a nod, shall we say. Although I like Penelope Cruz, I just saw her in Broken Embraces, the Almodovar film, which is, that movie has a lot of problems, but Penelope Cruz isn't one of them. I think she's quite good. So.
And the Best Actor and Best Actress categories? Best Actor, Jeff Bridges in Crazy Heart, George Clooney in Up in the Air, Colin Firth, A Single Man, Morgan Freeman in Invictus, and Jeremy Renner in The Hurt Locker.
I haven't seen Colin Firth, so I can't speak to his performance in A Single Man. The others, I think, are all quite good, although it's funny. I don't know Jeremy Renner very well, so but Bridges, Clooney, and Freeman are sort of all doing what they usually do. And all of them are quite good, but I don't feel like any of them have really, are stretching as an actor or doing anything that demands to be seen. I think of those four, maybe Morgan Freeman, just because I kind of like Morgan Freeman,
mm-hmm.
and I think what he does with Mandela is quite good. You?
I've only seen two of these, so I don't think I can really say, but I think I would. I think I'd have trouble choosing.
Yeah.
They don't stand out to me. So.
Fair enough. Best actress, I haven't seen two of these. So I haven't seen Helen Mirren or in The Last Station or Sandra Bullock in The Blind Side. Carey Mulligan in An Education is fine, but it feels like the sort of nomination where people go, oh, wow, she's pretty and we haven't seen her before. Let's nominate her. She's good and she's pretty, but I wouldn't say much more than that. And then Gabri Sidibe, I know I'm butchering the name, I apologize. And Precious is again kind of new and therefore exciting, and she's quite good. But I think Meryl Streep and Julia firmly deserves yet another winner, and she's fantastic as Julia Child. And so I'd be disappointed if she didn't win, although I could imagine people won't vote for her just because she seems to always win.
Yeah. She's just always so good. I've only seen a couple of these, and that wasn't one of them, but mm-hmm. I've heard that same comment from a lot of people that people who liked that movie loved her most of all.
Yeah.
They wanted more Julie and less Julia.
Yeah, maybe that's
sorry,
true.
I'm sorry, more Julia, less Julie.
It's I like Amy Adams, who plays Julie in that movie. And I like that movie. But what I like about the movie in particular is the relationship of Stanley Tucci, who plays Julia Child's husband, and Meryl Streep as mm-hmm. Julia Child. I think you don't often see in movies, a husband and wife relationship in middle age that is handled that beautifully. I think it's the movie is well worth seeing for that. And so I kind of hope Meryl Streep wins. Which category should we move on to next, Rob?
Best animated feature film has grown from three movies to five movies this year.
And deservedly so.
There were a lot of animated movies this year. Coraline, Fantastic Mr. Fox, The Princess and the Frog, The Secret of Kells, and Up. Mm-hmm. Now, Up is also nominated for Best Picture and is in my top three for that category. And so I have trouble sort of giving a nod to it again here, especially since I think there are other good movies in this category. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I do. I mean, I'm not as big a fan of Up as you are. But Coraline, Fantastic Mr. Fox, and Princess and the Frog, I think, are all really good. Secret of Kells hasn't opened here in Chicago yet. I think it does in early April, so I look forward to seeing it because I've heard good things about that too. But strangely, Up is my fourth favorite of this category. I know I'm in the minority on that, but I think Coraline is brilliant. I think Fantastic Mr. Fox is really fun. And I think Princess and the Frog is a surprisingly strong return to form for Disney, and it's, you know, sort of 2D animation, so I can get behind any of those films. Up, of course, will win, so my opinion is irrelevant.
But Coraline, I mentioned earlier, had a really unusual use of 3D, and the thing that that I remember most about it is that instead of trying to poke out at me and sort of exceed the bounds of the screen, which is what most 3D movies are trying to do, and therefore violate physics, the laws of physics, because every time these things sort of move out of the screen toward you, once they sort of hit the edge of the screen, they're suddenly thrust back
right.
away from you again, and you're reminded, oh, that's back there. It's not up here.
Right.
Coraline didn't do that. It all seemed to take place, except for a few little bits here and there, seemed to take place behind the screen. Mm-hmm. And yet, that didn't mean it wasn't in 3D. It looked like it really was right behind mm-hmm. the screen, moving around in the three dimensions behind the screen.
Right.
I don't remember seeing that before, and it was really effective, I think.
No, I agree. Yeah, Coraline, like I said earlier, is one of my favorite films of the year. And I think, in part because it's a beautiful marriage of this 3D form with a really interesting story. And, you know, the way it sort of tells this story is that the 3D really comes alive. Well, I need to back up for those people who haven't seen it or haven't read the book. But, you know, it's about this girl who sort of finds, as often happens in children's film, a sort of an alternate world, an alternate reality. But there, in the alternate reality, is an alternate mother, who initially seems a lot more enjoyable or interesting or friendly than her real mother. And so the young girl likes spending a lot more time in this alternate reality. And what I love about the film is that in the movie, the alternate reality is much more vibrant, both in terms of color, but also in terms of the 3D. And so therefore, the storyline is reflected in the way the film is made. And I think that's really, really great and clever. And then, of course, as the movie goes on and the girl realizes, oh, wait, maybe the alternate reality isn't so great. Again, the 3D is used, I think, to very, very powerful effect.
Yeah, that sort of split between the alternate world and the real world is almost like The Wizard of Oz or something, mm-hmm. again, where there's the black and white and color. And it's not black and white in color in this case, but it's a very sort of burlap-like texture in the real world and a, you know, plastic kind of texture in the alternate world, which is pretty neat.
It is neat. And I, again, I briefly touched on it, but I do encourage people to see Princess and the Frog. I think it's a nice story. I think the way it interrogates sort of a fairy tale world, I mean, whether it's you want to live in a fairy tale world is well handled, and the animation is beautiful, really, really beautiful. I'm saddened that it hasn't gotten as much audience as it should.
Best original screenplay. I think you've already tipped your hand on this one. But the nominees are Mark Bull for The Hurt Locker, Quentin Tarantino for Inglourious Basterds, Alessandro Kamen and Oren Moverman for The Messenger, Joel and Ethan Coen for A Serious Man, and Peter Docter, Bob Peterson, Tom McCarthy for Up.
Yeah.
And your nod goes to?
Yeah, Inglourious Basterds, although... I would have no problem if The Messenger won, because again, I think the way that story is constructed, and again, for people who may not know the film, it's about these two soldiers who are assigned to give the bad news to families when one of their loved ones has died in Iraq or Afghanistan. And Woody Harrelson plays the soldier who's been doing this for a while. He's an old hand at this. And then I forget the younger actor's name.
Yeah.
but and then the second soldier is new to the process, and of course it's a very difficult process to tell people. And so the way the script sort of introduces these two characters, and we get to know them as people, but also in this job that they do together, I think is very well handled. And so I like that screenplay a lot. You have preferences here? You have favorites?
The actor you're talking about, by the way, is Ben Foster.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, they're both. The movie's also about the obviously the emotional turmoil that those guys have to go through, even if they're whether they're new or old.
Yes, but again, in contrast, Up in the Air, and I think there's a useful parallel here. Yes, the story follows them, but when they do deliver the bad news, we really feel the pain and the anguish of the family members. I mean, so it's not that our sympathies don't lie with those people as well. They do. And I think that's why I like The Messenger much more than Up in the Air. It feels much more real to me, much more authentic than the Jason Reitman film does.
Yeah, in fact, the movie draws us into those families' lives by drawing these two characters into their lives.
Yep.
And so since they're our guides, we're pulled in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So which of the screenplays here do you particularly fancy?
For me, I think it would be really difficult to choose between Inglourious Basterds and A Serious Man. Mm-hmm. The Coen Brothers movie that we've talked about at length on this podcast before. I think both of those work like clockwork in strange, unexpected, inspired ways.
Yeah.
And both of them really made me think and still do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. And I, as we've talked about before, I'm not a huge fan of the Coen Brothers film, but certainly its screenplay is, I think, is one of its strongest elements. So I have a feeling I know which... one you'll choose for best adapted screenplay.
This will be the first mention in this podcast so far of my favorite film of 2009.
Go ahead, Rob.
The nominees are District 9, An Education, In the Loop, Precious, and Up in the Air. My favorite film of 2009 is In the Loop, the British comedy that is one of the sharpest political satires I've ever seen. And not only that, one of the most quotable films I've ever seen that is laugh out loud funny all the way through.
I don't like it as much as you do, Rob. I really like the first half. I don't for some reason I didn't laugh as much in the second half and didn't quite care as much about the characters as you do. But I would have no problem with that winning best adapted screenplay because it's a brilliant script and you're right, it's eminently quotable.
And the reason, by the way, it's under adapted screenplay is that it's the same guys who made a TV series in England called The Thick of It, which is also very funny, but it's just about British politics. And so In the Loop is interesting for having bridged this gap, and it's as much about America's involvement in wars as it is England's, and it's about the special relationship between these two countries and how sort of fake it kind of is.
Yeah.
But also it's interesting that it's under-adapted because it's not really the same characters except for maybe one from that series. It's a totally different thing, but it's the same actors and the same writer, director, creator. And so I guess that's why it's under-adapted. But people who liked In the Loop should definitely try to track down The Thick of It.
Yeah, good.
You have a pick in here?
That one. Yeah, that one. I mean, it's for me, that would be a fairly easy choice. It's amazing how I don't really like the scripts for any of the other four.
Yeah.
I mean, I sort of actively dislike, well, of course, I haven't seen District 9, but, you know, I sort of actively dislike the scripts for Up in the Air and In Education. So,
yeah, I actually hope this means In the Loop gets it.
Yeah.
It's, you know, up against a few stinkers.
Yeah. So, documentary feature is always an interesting category just because of the way these films are chosen. It's a somewhat different process than the other categories in that it goes through sort of a series of committees that sort of narrow the choices down. And so some years you get just five documentaries that you've like never heard of. This year there's four that I've heard of. Burma VJ, which was a documentary about the uprising in Burma about a year and a half ago. The Cove, which is about dolphin farming, I guess, or killing of dolphins. Am I getting this right? I haven't actually seen The Cove.
I haven't seen The Cove either.
Oh, okay.
It premiered at Sundance and I missed it.
Yeah, but it's supposed to be quite good. I just haven't gotten around to it. But I do know that it's about sort of how dolphins are killed by Japanese ships. So, and it apparently is quite controversial. Food Inc., which takes a look at sort of the food industry here in the United States. The Most Dangerous Man in America, Daniel Ellsberg and the Pentagon Papers. And then a movie that I'm not familiar with, Which Way Home. It's interesting. I like Food Inc. Burma VJ is fine. It's not fantastic. But those are the only two in this category that I've seen. Have you seen any of those?
Those are the two that I've seen also. Mm-hmm. And it's tough to choose between those two. The one of these that I most want to see is the Daniel Ellsberg film.
Mm.
But no, I think Food Inc. is an interesting case to talk about because it's not a great movie. Mm. It's not a super, it's a slickly made documentary, but it's trying to cover so much material that it's almost disorganized. Mm. You know, you've seen it.
Yeah.
It's a ton of information just sort of splayed out in front of you, and it's very hard to piece it together in your head or come up with any sort of coherent view of the world from the movie. But it does seem to give people so much to think about that they haven't, that many people who have seen the movie, based on my, you know, conversations with people, haven't thought about before, that it's made them seek out some of the sources for this movie, which are The Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan and
Fast Food Nation
by Eric Schlosser. These are two books that have been popular and influential and have made people really think about our food system. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of good stuff in the movie, and I especially liked seeing those two authors on screen talking about these issues. And also a farmer named Joel Salatin, who is sort of the model farmer that Michael Pollan talks about in The Omnivore's Dilemma, and who is doing lots of things in very interesting ways, very sustainable ways. Mm-hmm. So to hear him talk, he's a colorful guy and articulate, stands there in his overalls and points to his ecosystem and says, it's right there in this field, you know, it's all right there. That's fun. And so I think the way this is really profoundly affecting people and making them think about something that's very important is that's really good. And yet it's not a great cinematic experience, I think.
No,
so
I
it's hard to
right.
say. What do you award?
I would agree with that. I liked the movie more as it went on. And I think in part because the farmer, they spend more time with him, and he's a very charismatic figure and sort of gives a face to what the filmmakers are clearly trying to communicate. And so I think that's great. I also really appreciated how the movie tries to be very practical towards the end. You know, a lot of these movies, documentaries that try to sort of rouse people's feelings about something only do that. They only rouse people's emotions, and they don't give you any sense of what to do now that you've walked out of the theater. And I really applaud Food Inc. for trying to be very practical. And here are some things that you can do. And here are some things that you can read, and here are some websites that you can go to that will give you even more practical ideas. And so I found that useful and in a lot of ways.
I felt like it went a little soft on Walmart. It has a section on how Walmart is starting to sell Stonyfield Farms yogurt and how that's such a great thing that they have this organic yogurt in Walmart. And Walmart has so much power. They can do more than just carry Stonyfield Farms yogurt. And this is after talking about how organic is a sort of popular label. It doesn't always necessarily mean all the things that you'd want it to mean. And so, you know, it's a mixed bag. But anyway,
I agree. Movie. Yeah, it's on the other hand, I was happy that it ended when it did. I mean, if that had been a 3-hour film, I don't think I would have liked it as much.
Now, Burma Vijay, the other one that we've both seen here, I actively don't like.
Mm.
It is a very interesting story, and they have killer footage of this uprising in Burma. That was the footage was taken by people on their cell phones, and then they got it out of the country via satellite phones and all these nefarious means that are really, really crazy. And it's an intriguing story to hear.
Mm.
It's amazing footage to watch, and I feel like it's tainted in this movie by this aggressive reenactment strategy where they're reenacting so much that it blurs the line between what's real and what isn't real.
Mm.
And in this case, where the fact that it's real and on footage is the important thing, you know, this was the people who were doing this, and it's sort of been corrupted by that. And I'm not someone who dislikes reenactments in general. We've talked about that as we've talked about Errol Morris in the past. But he has a very clear strategy for why he uses them and how he uses them. He never tries to make you think that what you're seeing is real when it's not. And I got the feeling that these filmmakers occasionally didn't mind if you thought that, or at least didn't make it clear.
Yeah, I understand that problem, and I have sympathy for it. And in other words, I'm uncomfortable with that in this film, too. I'm a little bit more, I give this film a little more leeway just because of my guess is that if they only used the footage that they had, it might have been a very difficult story to tell. And so there might have been a sense in which, you know, to somehow tell a story in a way that people can understand, they need to reenact some things. Now, maybe they should have done it differently. Maybe they should have been a little more, maybe ethical or more honest about it. But I'm willing to give some leeway to that just because it's such a compelling story and an important story that has been mostly overlooked, at least in the American media. And so I don't love the film. Again, it's not a great documentary. I think the only documentary that I saw this year that I thought was really great was Anvil, The Story of Anvil, which is a movie about this heavy metal band from Canada that had sort of one shining moment back in the early to mid 80s and has basically been trying to recapture that glory ever since. But that movie is really interesting, in part because it is clearly informed by This is Spinal Tap. And very clearly is sort of mapping and onto Spinal Tap in certain ways, except, of course, whereas Spinal Tap was a mockumentary, Anvil, The Story of Anvil, is based on real guys and who have gone through real experiences. And so what is very funny in Spinal Tap is not funny, or at least not always funny, in Anvil. And I think the way the movie plays with that is really, really well interesting. The movie is... has a lot of, one of my big problems with documentaries over the last few years is it's become so easy to make them because you have, you know, easy digital video, you have, Final Cut Pro, anyone can edit it anymore. And yet what it's led to is a lot of lazy filmmaking. Whereas in Anvil, The Story of Anvil, they got the footage they needed. They've edited it in really useful ways. And they tell the story seamlessly. And I thought that was really, really strong and well worth people's time. And I'm disappointed that it's not up for an Academy Award because I think it's very worthy.
People love this movie. And I liked it too. It's a little bit like Behind the Music, but for a band that you've never heard of and that never quite made it, but is still trying, still has hope.
But don't you think that's different? And I think you're right, except that in Behind the Music, the reason why people would watch that show is to watch people that they had heard of descend into crap.
Uh-huh. And why then you pop watch back show. Out superficially
then,
at yes, the end.
Yeah. And then at the end, everyone gets back together. Whereas with Anvil, because you don't know these people, it has a very different emotional arc that the movie takes you on. And for me, that's what's interesting about the film.
This is a band that would kill for the Behind the Music arc.
Yes.
You know, they'd love to bottom out if it could have meant that they could have started big and had another resurgence, you know, and they just have never quite gotten the momentum for any of that.
Yeah.
I think I didn't appreciate the movie as much as you did until after you told me about the close it clearly parallels in some ways Spinal Tap. Mm-hmm. But when you told me that you felt like it really closely, more than I realized, parallels it, then it made me want to go back and watch it again and see it through that lens.
Yeah, especially if you're into music. I think it's a movie worth tracking down.
It's fun regardless. And it knows how to sort of have fun with these guys, but not necessarily... at their expense directly. You know, yep. It has a lot of compassion for this band.
Absolutely does. And I won't give this away, but there was one moment that happens actually in the credit sequence that also, you know, goes along with that. That's like, oh, and I realize there's more to this than kind of what the movie initially lets you realize. Yeah.
My favorite documentary of the year would have been Forbidden Lies.
Mm.
Did you see that?
I haven't seen. No, I still haven't tracked it down.
It's about a woman who was such an amazing liar. Mm. I mean, that is jaw-dropping. And it's hard to even explain it beyond that point, but this movie is an onion. You think you have figured out what's going on, and then it goes deeper and deeper and deeper, and you do not know where it ends.
Is that because the woman itself or the way the story is constructed?
It's both. It's very it feels like the movie is more clever than I realized when I started watching it. You know, I started watching it, sort of thought I knew what it was doing, thought I sort of knew what this woman in the movie was like. And then as it explored that woman, it became a more complex film too. And I realized, they were confident enough to make me believe they were not as savvy as they are, you know, and that's kind of a cool experience in a theater. Mm. The filmmakers are not as naive as they wanted you to believe at first. So it's a fun movie, and it's a very interesting movie too.
Oh, good. It's on the Netflix queue, so to speak.
Oh, good.
I just haven't quite got there yet.
So I think we have one more major category, and it is the notorious best foreign language film. Yeah.
I've at least heard of some of these. There's Jame, which is a film from Israel, which is actually opening up in Chicago next month. It's about sort of a neighborhood. It's kind of a crime thriller, from what I've read. Michael Haneke's The White Ribbon, which we should probably talk about here because we've both seen that. A movie from France called A Prophet. Have you seen this one?
No.
It's gotten great reviews, sort of been compared to a modern-day Godfather. That opens here in Chicago shortly.
People in Toronto seem to like it.
Yeah.
I talk to you.
And then there's a movie from Argentina, The Secret in Their Eyes is the English title, which is also opening up in Chicago here in a couple months. And it's another crime drama, but this one from Argentina. And then there's a film from Peru called The Milk of Sorrow, and that's the only one that I haven't actually heard of. The only one I've seen of these is the Hanukkah film.
Now, this is a strange category because of how it's done. Mm-hmm. The Academy accepts one submission from each country who wants to participate.
Yep.
And it doesn't have to have played in the U.S. Usually it hasn't. In fact, usually it's the reverse. They're hoping for an Academy nomination or, better yet, an award, and then that will push its box office business in the U.S. And so oftentimes these are also chosen by a committee, and so it's very...
By the way, chosen by a committee in the initial country...
Yes.
So, and then chosen by committee here in the United States to narrow it down to five.
Yeah, they look at this list of 50 movies, one from each country. And then, you know, and there are always weird weird rules, like Michael Haneke's film Cachet from several years ago was critically acclaimed, certainly one of my favorite movies of that year. He's an Austrian filmmaker, and so Austria tried to submit it, and they said, no, it's mostly in French. And then there was some problem with France not being able to submit it because of some other rules, and I don't remember exactly what they were, but there are always some weird controversies like that just because it tries to force movies into this very narrow funnel, basically, is the reason. So, you know, a lot of my favorite movies of the year are foreign. Mm. 35 Shots of Rum, Summer Hours, those sorts of things never appear here.
No.
It's almost always a disappointing category.
Yeah.
Last year was strange because I felt like three or four of the movies were very good movies that I had seen, and it was the other one that won. And I still haven't caught up with that, but maybe it's good too. I don't know. Of this, I have only seen The White Ribbon.
We've podcasted about Hanukkah at length before, but I think both you and I would agree that this is one of his weaker films, at least for our money. Not everyone thinks that. Lots of people really like this movie. It's set right before World War I in this little town in Germany, I think. I think it's a German town, not an Austrian town. And it's sort of an isolated little town and sort of in a feudal system. There's this sort of lord who owns a lot of the land and people work on the land. It's kind of a menacing town people start dying, or if they don't die, they're being harmed in some way. And some of them are children who are being harmed. Or tortured or hidden or kidnapped and a variety of things. And we're not quite sure why. We're not quite sure who's doing it. But the more we learn, the more we realize it must be someone in the town or some people in the town. And so in that sense, it has Hanukkah's trademark fascination with evil and where evil comes from and finding evil in the mundane. And there's a rigor to Haneke that is unmatched, I think, by any director in the world. And the way he uses his camera is particularly striking. And actually, I think, you know, the cinematography for White Ribbon has actually been nominated for an Academy Award as well. And,
yeah, and alongside the Harry Potter movie and Avatar, and strangely, it's true, yeah.
But it's but for me, the film, I haven't quite put my finger on why it doesn't work for me, and maybe I need to watch it again. But it felt like there was a lot of menace for not a lot of payoff. You know, in other Haneke films where you sort of sit there and like in Caché, I mean, there's times where you just can't even stand the tension. It's so great. I felt like there was huge payoff for that, and that it's not just Haneke sort of lecturing his audience, as sometimes people accuse him of, but that there was real power in what he was trying to do. Whereas here, it just kind of felt uncomfortable. And when it was over, I wasn't quite sure why I had sat there for 2 hours being uncomfortable.
Yeah, one of the reasons it didn't work for me, I felt like later that it might not be fair to the movie. And that is that Michael Haneke has in some ways made the same movie over and over again. He's definitely exploring a thesis, and it has to do in his other movies with video and media and the way we filter violence especially, but also anything that's uncomfortable in society, but especially violence through media and video, and how we sort of try to sanitize it that way. And there are many other aspects of that whole thesis of his, but that's sort of the thing he explores over and over and over again. And now all of a sudden we have a period film that takes place well before there was ever any video. Video is not a direct part of this story. You know, we're watching it on film, so you could sort of maybe try to see it through that filter, but it really seems like he's doing something different this time. And so I didn't know how to grab onto it. And there, by the end, I did feel that there were some of his similar workings going on. And every time I feel that he's on a single track, I like to discover that he's actually not. He's on multiple tracks, and it's up to us to sort of put them together. And I did feel like for a long part of this movie it was a single track, and I didn't know why he was telling this story. By the end, I thought, okay, maybe actually there are a few things happened that made me think maybe there are a couple of tracks here. Well, I'd like to revisit it.
What for you were those couple of tracks?
He suddenly, out of the blue, alludes to Archduke Ferdinand and these things that kicked off World War I. It's like, where in the world? Okay, maybe he's thinking about something completely different from what I was thinking about. You know, this, I should be thinking about this in a more allegorical sense or something like that. The other thing is, and this is sort of a meta thing, but we saw this in Toronto on video projection. It's shot in beautiful black and white on film. Was projected digitally, and this really irked a lot of people. And a lot of people who really felt strongly about this movie and saw it at Cannes said, we didn't see it. We didn't see the movie in Toronto. You can't see it that way. It's even curious to me that it's nominated for Best Cinematography. It makes me wonder what the Academy saw it on. You know, did they see it? I don't know. Now, to some people, this doesn't matter. But it's the fact that this controversy arose, just as I'm saying, this has nothing to do with video, makes me think, all right, I don't know that has anything to do with it. He couldn't have predicted that necessarily, but there's another little piece of this puzzle. And Haneke, in the way he works, I think invites this kind of thinking, where you're always trying to figure out, what am I not seeing? What am I supposed to see in this picture? It's not a matter of deciphering. It's a matter of him showing you things that you don't see right away. He's very good at that, and it makes me want to, more than the other disappointments I saw in 2009, this one I want to revisit with sort of fresh eyes and see if maybe there is more to it. Maybe there's not.
Yeah, and I certainly will as well, just because I think Haneke is, you know, his track record shows that he deserves that. You know, it's I don't know if there's a more vital filmmaker working today, at least for me. And so even though, and it's not that I thought this was a horrible film by any means, it was just sort of disappointing by his standards. And that may say a lot more about me than him. And so
it says something about him too, I think, that he normally makes such incredibly strong films that when he makes a pretty good one, people are like, eh.
And I sometimes wonder, and this is part of it too, is to bring it back to the Oscars, for people who haven't seen a lot of Haneke films, which I'm sure is true for most people in the Academy, this may be one of their first experiences. Maybe they saw Caché, but you know they probably haven't seen much more than that. Then for them, it might be very interesting, exciting, in the same way that the first time I saw you know, Time of the Wolf was unbelievably vital. And maybe for them, that sort of feeling of discovering someone is part of why this film has gotten a lot of acclaim. Whereas for people who have seen Hanukkah, it doesn't have the same, you know, level of excitement.
Also, period movies sometimes tend to appeal to a certain kind of Academy voter, I think. And the other thing is that Michael Haneke's movies often have the structure of a mystery, and this one certainly does. Mm-hmm. There is a mystery here. There's always the question of whether Haneke himself even cares about the mystery, or how important is it that you try to solve the mystery, because he usually has a little bit of the answer, but not quite as fully as you'd like it to be, if you're really interested in solving the mystery. And so a mystery story is certainly easier to grasp onto than something that's a really complex, essay on video in our society.
This
has a more simplified, I think, structure of a mystery than
something that's I think that's right. So, any other films from 2009 that are worth highlighting, even if the Academy didn't?
There was a crazy Canadian movie called Pontypool that I just want to throw a quick nod out to. It's in some ways a zombie movie. I'm not normally one who goes for midnight films or for horror films, although I love a really good scary movie. This isn't really a good scary movie, but it's almost a kind of a chamber piece. It takes place mostly in a radio station with just two characters on the screen. One is the on-radio personality, on-air personality, sitting in a booth, and the other is his engineer who's taking calls from people who are outside. And the people outside are being attacked by zombies. But you don't see any of that. It's all like, it's all internal, and it's all very tense and very interesting. But the other thing is that it's about language. It's really about the way language can be a force for good or evil, and that it spreads the virus or whatever it is. Also, the end of the movie, which feels maybe a little disappointing because it feels almost like it succumbs to a certain sort of zombie genre expectation, I think it actually flips to the alternate reality. You were talking earlier about movies that have the alternate reality and the real reality. This one sort of goes through the looking glass, in my opinion, and I think if you see it that way, it makes the ending far more interesting.
Oh, okay.
It's called Pontypool.
Good. A movie I'd like to highlight, and you and I have talked about this, is James Gray's Two Lovers.
Oh, yeah.
That came out last spring, I think, starring Joaquin Phoenix and Gwyneth Paltrow. Got a lot more press because of how weird Joaquin Phoenix acted in his sort of the marketing of the movie. But the movie, I think, is really strong. I think Phoenix is fantastic. It's this, he plays this guy who's living at home. The movie opens with him sort of attempting to commit suicide. It doesn't seem to have a lot of meaning in his life. And he kind of finds it by grasping onto this potential relationship. And Gwyneth Paltrow is unfortunately not great, but Joaquin Phoenix is fantastic, and I thought the cinematography is really striking, and the way Gray tells this story was well worth people's time. Again, it came and went, but it's worth finding on Netflix. So
I don't think we often see characters like the one played by Joaquin Phoenix in that movie as the center point of a movie. Also, that's really interesting. He has sort of two relationships with women in that movie. One is the Gwyneth Paltrow, the sort of more glamorous blonde girl, and then the one who we know he should be with.
Yeah.
And yet he wants the, you know, it's sort of, he drifts between them, and it's sort of fun. It's not what I would call a fun movie, and yet there is some sort of fun in watching to see which way it's going to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I like that film. Three real quick movies, not new, old films that I caught up with. One has just been released by Criterion, Make Way for Tomorrow. I finally saw for the first time this past year.
Me too.
It's just awesome. It's just awesome. Leo McCarey's ode to sort of, an old couple who are... I don't want to give too much away. It's just a great, great film. I don't know if you want to say anything specific about it. I just wanted to tell people to go see it or to get it.
I want to watch this movie when I turn 40, when I turn 50.
Yeah.
I want to watch it again when I turn 60. People had told me before, Girish had told me personally that I need to see this movie because I love Tokyo Story so much, the Ozu film, and this was an inspiration for Ozu. It's just a beautiful, beautiful movie.
Yeah, it's a... the last half hour, I think, is one of my favorite pieces of cinema I've seen in I don't know how long. I mean, it's just there's this elderly couple are forced at the beginning of the film to sell their house. It takes place during the Depression, and they have to sell their house, and they have to therefore live with their children who are middle aged. And the children are, they love their parents, but they don't really want to take care of their parents. And so the parents have to split up. And then the last half hour is the parents coming back together again. And I won't say anything more than that, except to say that it's unbelievably beautiful and incredibly emotional. And it's a melodrama in the best way. Another film I saw this year for the first time, which not many people have a chance to see, but I have to highlight it anyway. Doc Films here in Chicago did a series on Stan Brakhage, and they showed his film Text of Light, which is just a series of shots that Brakhage shot of light going through a ashtray. I never realized how beautiful light could be. And so if you ever get a chance to see that, it's fantastic. So anything else that you got to see this year for the first time?
I think that sums it up. That's a good point right there.
All right. So